You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK Quad Cities NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today my guest is the author of a very timely book that synthesizes several key trends into a coherent narrative that just makes so much sense to me in light of our ongoing political drama in the United States. And I think listeners will hear the relevance of Michael's book to the political landscape here in the Midwest, especially during the Trump era. The book is called The New Class War, Saving Democracy from the Managerial Elite, and the author is Michael Lind. Michael's written more than a dozen books, served as editor or writer for publications such as The New Yorker, Harper's, The New Republic, and The National Interest, and he's taught at Harvard and Johns Hopkins University, and he's currently teaching at the University of Texas. Michael, thank you so much for being a guest today.
Thank you for having me.
I really salute you for this book. It is, as I said, it makes so much sense after going through it and just kind of contemplating how you bring things together here in a way that makes a lot of sense. But try to lay out, I guess, the overall theme here of democratic pluralism and how it's been replaced by, you call it the technocratic neoliberalism, but break that down and for our listeners in the areas that that's happened and what have been the consequences in our country.
Well, I argue that you see an increasing polarization along class lines between the working class, defined broadly as people with high school education, maybe a little bit more, and college-educated people, who are a third of the population at most, and particularly professionals and managers. Who are sometimes described as the managerial elite, people with graduate and professional degrees, who tend to occupy the leading positions of authority in large bureaucracies, not only in the private sector and corporations, but also in governments and nonprofits. And on both sides of the Atlantic, this is not just an American phenomenon. We see a sort of sorting taking place with parties of the center left, like the Democrats, becoming more and more upscale, with more and more affluent voters, allied often with immigrants and with native non-white voters, against the mostly white working class, not entirely. There's some trend towards non-white working class people to join this other coalition. So what is happening as a result of this class picturing between the managerial, highly college credential group and the working class majority is a replacement of the old-fashioned left-right division in politics with a new sort of insider-outsider division. And this is manifested in different ways in different countries. In our own country, the managerial elite, I argue, was represented by the centrist wings of both the Democratic and the Republican parties. If you go back to 2015, before Donald Trump entered the race, people expected that we might have the wife of a former president, Hillary Clinton, facing off against the brother and son of two former presidents, Jeb Bush, and instead, you had really dramatic challenges to from the left by Bernie Sanders in 2016, and the ultimately successful challenge to the mainstream Republicans by Donald Trump in 2016. So clearly, there are significant numbers of people who feel sufficiently alienated from the mainstream parties that they would rally behind these outsider candidates, Sanders, as well as Trump. And if you look at the map, there tends to be a correlation between areas that are suffering economic distress, particularly industrial regions in the Midwest, similar depressed industrial areas in Britain and in continental Europe, and support for populist outsider candidates. So in short, I argue that this has got deep roots. Trump was not a fluke. That is, he channeled forces which probably will still be there for some time, unless these alienated voters can be incorporated into a political system that listens to their voices and responds to their interests.
You showed how, this pluralism has been replaced by this managerial elite in three areas: the economy, politics, and culture. But boy, in our region, I think you're right on all three levels, but in our region, the economic change was really plain for everybody to see. Go through that with us a little bit on how that's changed the economy, with the impact it's had on so many working class folks, especially here in our region.
My argument in the new class war is that class conflict, and I'm not a Marxist, you don't have to believe in Marxism to believe that there are classes and they have conflicts with each other. The modern class has originated with industrialization in Western Europe and the U.S. in the 19th century. And so by the early 1900s, you had a very large group of industrial workers. You had this new class of managers and executives who were not necessarily the owners of factories, but they were the employers, and they were the leaders of them. And from the Civil War all the way up until the New Deal, there was very brutal labor violence in the United States, with strikers trying to shut down railroads and factories, companies hiring goons to beat up union workers and activists, the National Guard and sometimes the Army being sent in. And we only got over this earlier class conflict thanks to both Republicans and Democrats in the middle of the 20th century accepted the legitimacy of organized labor and the idea that corporations have some kind of responsibility to the community. So really it was collective bargaining and organized labor, which I think were essential to the class compromise in the 1950s and 60s and 70s. Since then, as a result of employer onslaughts against unionization, offshoring, moving factories to right-the-work states, largely in the South, the private sector unions have collapsed. About 6% of private sector workers now in the U.S. belong to unions, compared to 7% under Herbert Hoover. That's how all of the gains for organized labor in the private sector since the 1930s have been wiped out. And this has a major impact on politics as well as on wages and inequality, because the unions, and they had many flaws. I'm not defending historic unions, in every respect, but they acted as intermediaries that integrated working class people and were able to make a case for them, not only to employers, but also to politicians. And when unions vanish, particularly in areas where the jobs are vanishing too, like a lot of the industrial Midwest, you get a lot of isolated, angry people. And some of them simply pay no attention to politics. They think it's they can have no influence. But sometimes they rally behind demagogic outsiders like Donald Trump. And so what I mean by pluralism is a system in which mass membership organizations, of which the most important historically have been trade unions, churches, and other religious institutions were very important, more so in the past than at the present, and local political organizations, managed to give people a sense of agency and power, even though they themselves don't have personal wealth or high levels of education.
And when the managerial class, the elite, pushed globalization, and I remember this, that this was explained going back to Bill Clinton, that, we're going to take you that used to work in a factory and we're going to retrain you. And later it became, you can relocate somewhere to get another job. You really deconstruct that in a good way in the book that really describes how again, it's a great example of the weakness of this approach versus the way, you know, it used to be.
Yeah, well, globalization was sold on the basis that the people who lost their jobs in automobile manufacturing would either stay in Detroit or they'd move to San Francisco and learn to code and become much better paid software writers or something like that. Well, that clearly didn't happen. If you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics projection for most of the jobs that will be created in the next 10 years, the majority of them require no education beyond high school, maybe a little on-the-job training. They pay in the low or middle 20s, you know, $20,000, $25,000. They're mostly low-wage, low-prestige occupations like home health aide or restaurant cook. So the jobs of the future that we were promised by Bill Clinton and by his successors, you know, these college-educated jobs, everybody was supposed to go to college because all of the jobs of the future would require college education and they'd pay well, they just never materialized. There are some jobs like that, but there are very few of them. And, you know, the number of software engineers and programmers is greatly outnumbered by janitors and home health aides. So the existing narrative, as I point out in my book, the new class war, is totally at odds with reality, and we need to address the real problem, which is that most of the jobs that will be created in the U.S. will not require a college degree. The problem with them is not that they're bad jobs. Any job can be a decent job if you have respect and decent wages. It's they pay poorly. And there's no collective bargaining, no organized labor to act as a counterweight against abusive employers.
There's been a question debated. I've asked numerous guests this. It goes back to Thomas Frank's thesis in his book, What's the Matter with Kansas, that working class folks don't vote their own interests. I hear this all the time. I feel like it's a kind of condescending viewpoint. What's your take on that question?
Well, I disagree with that. Usually it's Democrats who are now the party of the affluent professional and managerial class, mostly, at least among non-Hispanic whites. And they say, well, you know, to working class people, including African Americans and Hispanics, who shifted more towards the Republicans in the last two cycles, even though most non-white voters still vote for the Democrats, they say, well, we don't like your socially conservative religion. You know, we think you don't have any taste. But we reject your complaints about offshoring production to China or Mexico. We don't think you have legitimate concerns about unskilled immigrants straining public services or competing with you in the workforce. So basically, we despise you, but we'll give you a $500 tax credit. And then when, you know, these working class voters reject the offer, then these progressives say, well, we offered them a $500 tax credit and they didn't take it. They're voting against their own interests.
Yeah, I think that folks have varied interests beyond economics that they put into their values. And the same folks that look down on the working class, I guess, for voting a certain way are also the ones that criticize them perhaps for not picking up and leaving for more job opportunities when they may want to stay with family or other values that are at least as important.
Well, one of the statistics I include in the book is the fact that the average American, the study used women because they live longer, the average American lives within 18 miles of her mother. And I love using this among college-educated professionals like me because we're very geographically mobile. We, you know, go to different cities, pursue our careers, and I like to ask them, well, how many of you live within 18 miles of your mother? There's nobody. So there's a huge class divide, the working class in the U.S. And again, I'm not talking about the white working class. I'm talking about working class of all races, in native and immigrant. They tend to be much more dependent on their families to provide child care, among other things, or they care for their elderly relatives and parents. The what I call the overclass, the college-educated managerial elite, pays other people to take care of their children. They pay other people to take care of their elderly relatives because they can. So there's a real lifestyle difference. If you want to succeed as a professional in the U.S., you leave your family behind, you leave your neighborhood, you travel across the country to some place with a prestigious university, and then after you graduate, then you go to San Francisco or Wall Street or, you know, Austin, where I am now, wherever, to pursue your career, whatever it may be. You know, seldom see your family. And if you're a two-earner couple, you know, then you're paying for daycare, you know, to raise your kids. Working class people, you know, tend to have relatives help out with child care. So when it comes to family structure, you know, geographic mobility, lifestyle, there's just a huge gap between the educated overclass and the working class majority.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Michael Lind, who's an author of a new book called The New Class War, which I strongly recommend if you're interested in some of the bigger trends going on in this country and an explanation. And I'll tell you, I have, for listeners out there that have started listening or caught most of our conversation, Michael's argument here cuts across partisan and ideological lines. I have no idea if Michael's a Democrat or Republican, conservative or liberal. That's what I define as a good book, because it really cuts across those lines to really make you think, and it makes sense of a lot of broader trends we're seeing, at least in my opinion. Michael, there's also, I believe it was a book written by Yuval Levin, who talked about the politics of nostalgia. I just want to give you an opportunity here. You're not talking about going back to the 1950s here.
No, if anything, we need to be more automated when it comes to factories and introduce robots even more, even if that destroys some jobs in some sectors. The majority of Americans in the 21st century work in the non-traded domestic service sector and increasingly the healthcare sector and recreation and entertainment are creating more and more jobs. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, you're never going to go back to having, you know, the vast amount of the population employed in manufacturing, even if for national security reasons. In economic reasons, you want to bring some of the manufacturing back. It will be done by a few well-paid people in highly robotic factories. What we need to do is create the functional equivalent of the well-paid industrial working class of the 20th century in this century. Remember, there was nothing inherently great about working at factory jobs. These were terrible jobs. Mm-hmm. In the 1920s and the 19-teens. You know, there was no eight-hour day. You could be forced to work for 18 hours a day for 6 days a week. It was only government regulation, wages and hours laws, plus unions and collective bargaining that turned these really terrible dehumanizing factory jobs into the relatively decent factory jobs that you think about for the male breadwinner in the 1950s. And so I reject technological determinism. As I mentioned, there are enormous numbers of jobs being created for health aides and for elder care nurses and for janitors and security guards. Those can either be jobs for the working poor without benefits, with no labor representation, or they can be decent jobs that allow you to have a decent working class existence and buy a home and have children. And that's a decision for society to make. It's not something that will be determined by technology by itself.
And you're not saying put up walls and cut off globalization or anything. You talk instead about something called selective globalization. What's that?
Well, both countries and also states and cities within them want to have at least some of the businesses be export businesses, because most of the growth in consumer demand in this century is going to be outside of the United States. There's a growing global middle class in Asia, in Africa, the Middle East, Latin America. And so you want to have at least part of the population engaged in making things that you can sell to them. It doesn't have to be finished products. It can be, you know, automobile mufflers or aerospace components that get assembled somewhere else. But if you have those traded sector export industries within your country or your county or your state, and the market for it is growing, that's like a siphon of money. It's just bringing in money to your local area. So it's essential for economic development, even if the majority of people in your city or your state or your nation are engaged in what are called non-traded domestic service sector jobs. So you want a mix, and you certainly want access to foreign markets. At the same time, you do not want countries that cheat the way China has systematically cheated to favor their industries at the expense of your own, to wipe out, you know, your strategic manufacturing industries. So at the end of the day, either you cut a deal with them and have some kind of managed trade, or everyone agrees on the same basic set of rules. So you have to balance the need for exports and to open up foreign markets with the need to prevent other countries from wiping out your own industries through unfair and unbalanced trade.
I thought your take on politics was really interesting as well, because I think it captures what I've seen certainly in my role in politics over the years, where we've gone from more of a decentralized emphasis of the ward and the neighborhood, organizing that way, to big money, self-funded candidates, more, and the rise of consultants. And I wonder whether that may be changing just a little bit. But I see that clearly. And the impact that has on politics, again, is that combined with the decline of trade unions is less of a voice of working class folks in the political process.
Well, working class people as individuals, they lack wealth. They can't influence politics that way. They lack prestige. They lack social connections. To policymakers, the only thing working class people have is their numbers. And their numbers are useless unless they are organized in mass membership organizations. And unions are one example. Religious congregations are another. But another important example is the local party, the local precincts. And up until the 70s and 80s, as you recall, American parties were national federations, basically of local chapters and clubs. That has all disintegrated. At this point, the parties are really just kind of like corporate labels, which various investors and the candidates they invest in, sometimes self-financed candidates, fight for. And look at Trump. He was apparently a Democrat for much of his life. He, as a donor, he gave money to both parties. He tried and failed to take over Ross Perot's Reform Party around the year 2000. And then he decided to try to run as a Republican and succeeded. If things had gone differently and Michael Bloomberg had been the Democratic nominee this year, he would have had two New York billionaires disliked by much of their parties, would have been the Republican and the Democratic nominee for president. So this is another example where an intermediate institution that used to empower ordinary people at the local level, in this case, the local political parties, has just disintegrated. And power has migrated upward towards a small number of people with a great amount of personal resources.
I couldn't help thinking as I read through your book and of a recent article I saw on how journalism has changed so much, where In the heyday of journalism back in the 1900s and all, you had reporters who didn't have college degrees. And nobody here is beating up people with college degrees. That's not the point. But you had a more accurate reflection, perhaps, of the working class. And now I think a manifestation of that was the shock and dismay a lot of the reporters had from the coasts when Trump won here in the Midwest. They came out here and talked to everybody like lab rats. And there was no understanding of working class issues. I just kept thinking of that as I was reading through your book.
Yeah, this is a fairly recent phenomenon. A famous journalist I know who came from a very rich old Mayflower Wasp family told me that when he went into journalism in the 60s, his family was just aghast. You know, it's like, people from the Ivy League did not become reporters. This was a working class profession. And according to him, it was the movie All the King's Men about the Watergate.
All the President's
about
Men.
Woodward and Bernstein, that this made it fashionable for college-educated people to become journalists. And the other factor has been that as ad revenue has been stripped away from newspapers and magazines by Craigslist and other things on the Internet, their revenues have collapsed, and their salaries for journalists have collapsed. So now, really, you have to have a trust fund to be a journalist because the pay is so low. So it's a real social problem because, as you point out, by 2016, journalists tend to be rich kids, frankly, from wealthy families, and a big change from the past. And they actually tend to come from a higher social stratum, not only than most voters, but even than a lot of politicians. You know, they're kind of snobs. They look down their noses at them.
We just have like a minute left. You say this new class war comes to an end in one of two ways. Can you kind of summarize that in just a minute or so?
Yeah, well, either one class crushes the other, and it's not going to be the working class, so it would mean that we just have an oligarchy where the managers and employers just keep working class people weak and subordinate. That's the nightmare view. The optimistic view is that there is a compromise where the managerial class agrees to share power with workers, which can't be done with workers as individuals. It has to be through some kind of forms of negotiation with mass membership organizations, which can be civic and religious as well as organized labor. So let's hope it ends in class compromise, not class victory for the overclass.
You say that the establishment response is a greater threat to democracy than populism itself. I'll let our listeners kind of chew on that one. It's a great book, folks. It's called The New Class War, and it's by Michael Lind. I recommend you get it. Take a read, and very interesting contribution to the ongoing important challenges facing us. Michael, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us
today. WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.